the front yard way before he got there. I scrolled down to reply. Hey, brother. Damn. I know you're not there, but writing you at your email, with that last message up there, it feels like you're still here. Being around the guys feels like that too. You must be wondering what I've been up to. Maybe you see. Maybe you know. If you do, you must be like, what the fuck? 3D printed gun? Shit. I felt the same way when I first saw it, just laughing like a crazy person when it came out. And I know you wouldn't approve. I'm sorry, but we need the money. Mom lost her job. After you died, she just stayed in bed. I couldn't get her out. I don't know where rent's coming from next month. We'll get an extra month if we get evicted, but shit, we've been in this house our whole lives. Your pictures are still up. I still have to see you everywhere in here. So we're not just gonna go. We've been here our whole lives. We don't have anywhere to go. You know what's funny? I'm all like, street and shit in real life. But online I don't talk like that, like I am now. So it feels weird too. Online I try to sound smarter than I am. I mean, I choose what I type carefully because that's all people know about me. What I type. What I post. It's pretty weird on there. Here. The way you don't know who people are. You just get their avatar names. Some profile picture. But if you post cool shit, say cool shit, people like you. Did I tell you about the community I got into? The name of the place. The online community is Wundercode. It's fucking Norwegian. You probably don't know what code is. I got way into it after you died. I didn't feel like going out or going to school or nothing. When you spend enough time online, if you're looking, you can find some cool shit. I don't see it as that much different from what you did. Figuring out a way around a big fucking bully system that only gives those that came from money or power the means to make it. I learned from YouTube how to code. Shit like JavaScript, Python, SQL, Ruby, C++, HTML, Java, PHP. Sounds like a different language, right? It is. And you get better by putting in the time and taking to heart what all the motherfuckers have to say about your abilities on the forums. You have to know how to tell the difference. Whose criticism to take and whose to ignore. Long story short, though, is that I got hooked into this community. And I realized I could get whatever I wanted. Not drugs and shit. I mean, I could, but that's not what I want. The 3D printer I got was itself printed by a 3D printer. No shit. A 3D printer printed by a 3D printer. Octavio fronted me the money. Part of what kills me about you being gone is that I never really said anything to you. Even when you emailed me, I didn't even really know how much I wanted to say to you until the day you left. Until I felt that feeling of losing you on the lawn out there, right on that same spot where that boy's blood stained the grass. But you showed me. I knew how much you loved me. You did shit like how you got me that expensive ass Schwinn. Probably used to be some hipster's bike, you probably stole it, but still, you stole it from me. And in some ways that's even better than if you bought it. Especially if it was from one of those white boys trying to take Oakland over from the west. You should know they haven't made it to the deep east yet. Probably never will. Shit's mean out here. But everything from High Street to West Oakland, that shit seems doomed to me. Anyway, I mostly see Oakland from online now. That's where we're all gonna be mostly eventually. Online. That's what I think. We're already kinda moving in that direction if you think about it. We're already like fucking androids, thinking and seeing with our phones all the time. You might wanna know more about some other shit, like what's going on with Mom. She gets out of bed more now. But she just moves to the TV. She looks out the window a lot too. Peeks out the curtains like she's still waiting for you to come home. I know I should be around her more, but she makes me feel hella sad. The other day she dropped a votive candle on the kitchen floor. Shit shattered. And she just left it there in pieces. Like, shit's broken, but we can't just leave it broken. all out there in the living room, like your picture on the mantle. Shit feels like it cuts me whenever I see it. How you graduated from high school and we all thought shit would be okay from then on because you did. After you died, I had this dream. It started off, I was on an island. I could just barely see that there was another island across the way. There was hella fog in the way, but I knew I had to get over there, so I swam over. The water was warm and really blue, not gray or green like the bay. When I got over to the other side, I found you in a cave. You had all these fucking pit bull puppies in a shopping cart. You were duplicating them in the cart, the pit bulls. You were handing me the puppies as they duplicated in your shopping cart. You were making all those pit bulls for me. So when I first heard about this 3D printer that could print a version of itself, I thought of you and the pit bulls. The idea about the gun came later. I learned to be okay with Octavio. He started talking to me like I wasn't just your little brother. He asked me if I needed work. I told him about Mom being in bed all the time and he cried. He wasn't even drunk. I needed to figure out a way to support me and Mom. I know you wanted me to get an education, go to college, get a good job, but I want to be able to help right now, not in 4 years, not owing hella money just to work in an office somewhere. So then I got to thinking about how I might help. I'd read about these guns you could print. I didn't know then what they might be used for. I got the .cad file, the G-code. After I got the printer, I printed a gun. First thing I printed. Then I made sure it would work. I rode my bike over near the Oakland airport. That spot you took me to one time, where you can see the planes come down close. I figured I could fire one off there, and no one would hear it. A big-ass Southwest 747 came down, and I shot a bullet into the water. It hurt my hand, and the gun got a little hot, but it worked. Now I've got 6 of these pieces. Octavio said he'd give me $5,000 for all of them. He's got something going. All my shit's untraceable, so I'm not worried about the government coming after me. I am worried about what the guns will do, where they'll end up, who they might hurt or kill. But we're family. I know Octavio can be a mean motherfucker. So could you. But here it is. Manny. He said they're gonna rob a fucking powwow. Crazy, right? Shit sounded fucking stupid to me at first. Then it had me fucked up 'cause of Dad. You remember he used to always tell us we're Indian? But we didn't believe him. It was like we were waiting for him to prove it. Doesn't matter, because of what he did to Mom. To us, that piece of shit, deserved what he got. He had it coming. Long time coming. He would have killed Mom. Probably you too, if you hadn't beat his ass. I only wish I had a white gun to give you then. So let them rob a powwow. Whatever. Dad never taught us anything about being Indian. What's that got to do with us? Octavio said they could make $50,000. Said he'd give me another 5 if they pulled it off. As for me, I mostly spend my time online. I'm gonna graduate from high school. My grades are all right. I don't really like anyone at school. My only friends are your old friends, but they don't really care about me except that I can make them guns now. Except Octavio. I know how much it all messed him up. You gotta know that. You can't think it didn't fuck him up, right? Anyway, I'll keep writing you here. I'll keep you updated. It's anyone's guess what's gonna happen. For the first time in a long time, I got a little hope in my chest. Not that it's gonna get better. Just that it's gonna change. Sometimes that's all there is. 'Cause that means there's something going on, somewhere inside all of it, all that turning the world is always doing. That means it was never supposed to stay the same heat. Miss you. Daniel. Octavio brought me the first $5,000 the day after I showed them all the guns. I left $3,000 of it on the kitchen table in a blank envelope like Manny used to do. With the other $2,000, I bought a drone and a pair of virtual reality goggles. I've been wanting a drone ever since I found out about the powwow. I knew Octavia wouldn't let me go, but I wanted to see it, to make sure it went all right. Otherwise, it was on me, and if shit went wrong, that was it. Octavia's plan was all I had with my mom like she was. Decent drones are affordable now, and I'd read that flying one with a camera and live feed with VR goggles felt like flying. The drone I got had a 3-mile range and could stay in the air for 25 minutes. The camera on it shot 4K resolution. The Coliseum was only a mile away from our house on 72nd. I flew it from my backyard. I didn't want to waste any time, so I went straight up, about 50 feet in the air, then straight over the BART station. The thing could really move. I was in it. My eyes. The VR goggles. Out in the back of center field, I went straight up and saw a guy pointing at me from the bleachers. I flew closer to him. He was a maintenance worker, holding a trash grabber and a trash bag. The old guy got his binoculars out. I went even closer. What could he do? Nothing. I flew almost all the way up to the guy's face, and he tried to reach out to the drone. He got mad. I realized I was messing with him. I shouldn't have. I pulled away and dropped back down to the field. I headed toward the right field wall, then down the foul line back to the infield. At first base, I noticed the drone had 10 minutes of battery life left. I wasn't about to lose $1,000 out there, but I wanted to finish at home plate. When I got there, just as I was about to turn the drone around, I saw the old guy from the bleachers coming for me. He was on the field and pissed, like he was gonna grab the drone and slam it to the ground, step on it. I backed up, but forgot to rise. Luckily, I'd been playing video games for long enough that my panicked brain was hardwired to perform well under pressure. But for a second, I was close enough to count the wrinkles in the old guy's face. He managed to hit it, which almost caused the drone to come down, but I rose, went straight up, quick, like 20 or 40 feet in seconds. I cleared the walls and came straight home to my backyard. At home, I watched the video over and over, especially the part at the end where the guy almost got me. Shit was exciting. Real. Like I'd been there. I was about to call Octavio to tell him about it when I heard a scream upstairs. My mom. Ever since Manny got shot, I'd felt in a constant state of worry, half expecting some bad shit to happen all the time. I ran up the stairs, and when I got to the top, I opened the door and saw my mom holding the envelope, flipping through the cash with her finger. Did she think Manny left it? Like he made it back somehow, or like he was still here? Did she think this was a sign? I was about to tell her it was me, and Octavio, when she came over and hugged me. She pulled my head into her chest. Just kept saying, "Sorry. I'm so sorry." I thought she meant about how she'd been in bed, how she'd given up. But then as she kept saying it, I took it to mean how everything had happened to us. How much we lost. How we'd once been together as a family. How good it had once been. I tried to tell her it was okay. I kept repeating, "It's okay, Mom." One for each of her sorries. But then pretty soon, I found myself saying sorry back. And we both said sorry back and forth until we started to cry and shake.
Blue. Paul and I got married Teepee way. Some people call it the Native American church, or peyote way. We call peyote medicine because it is. I still mostly believe that in the same way I believe most anything can be medicine. Paul's dad married us in a teepee ceremony 2 years ago, in front of that fireplace. That's when he gave me my name. I was adopted by white people. I needed an Indian name. In Cheyenne, it's Ota Tavo Ome. But I don't know how to say it right. It means the blue vapor of life. Paul's dad started calling me Blue for short, and it stuck. Up until then, I'd been Crystal. Almost all I know about my birth mom is that her name is Jackie Redfeather. My adoptive mom told me on my 18th birthday what my birth mom's name is, and that she's Cheyenne. I knew I wasn't white. But not all the way. Because while my hair is dark and my skin is brown, when I look in the mirror, I see myself from the inside out. And inside, I feel as white as the long, white, pill-shaped throw pillow my mom always made me keep on my bed, even though I never used it. I grew up in Moraga, which is a suburb just on the other side of the Oakland Hills, which makes me even more Oakland Hills than the Oakland Hills kids. So I grew up with money, a pool in the backyard, an overbearing mother, an absent father. I brought home outdated racist insults from school like it was the 1950s. All Mexican slurs, of course, since people where I grew up don't know natives still exist. That's how much those Oakland Hills separate us from Oakland. Those hills bend time. I didn't do anything about what my mom told me on my 18th birthday right away. I sat on it for years. I kept on feeling white while being treated like any other brown person wherever I went. I got a job in Oakland at the Indian Center, and that helped me to feel more like I belonged somewhere. Then one day I was looking on Craigslist and saw that my tribe in Oklahoma was hiring a youth services coordinator. That's what I was doing in Oakland, so I applied, not really thinking I would get it. But I got it, and moved out to Oklahoma a few months later. Paul was my boss then. We moved in together just a month after I got there. Super unhealthy from the get-go. But part of why it went so fast is because of ceremony. Because of that medicine. We sat up every weekend. Sometimes it was just me, Paul, and his dad if no one else showed up. Paul took care of the fire, and I brought in water for Paul's dad. You don't know the medicine unless you know the medicine. We prayed for the whole world to get better, and felt it could every morning when we came out of the teepee. The world just spins, of course. But it all made perfect sense for a while. In there. I could evaporate and drift up and out through the crisscrossed teepee poles with the smoke and prayers. I could be gone and all the way there at once. But after Paul's dad died, everything I'd been praying about all that time got turned upside down and emptied on top of me, in the form of Paul's fists. After the first time, and the second, after I stopped counting, I stayed, and kept staying. I slept in the same bed with him, got up for work every morning like it was nothing. I'd been gone since that first time he laid hands on me. I applied for a job back where I used to work in Oakland. It was the position of events coordinator for the powwow. I had no experience in coordinating events outside of the annual youth summer camps. But they knew me there, so I got the job. I watched my shadow grow long, then flatten on the highway, as a car flies by without slowing or seeming to notice me. Not that I want slowing or notice. I kick a rock and hear it ding against a can or some hollow thing in the grass. I pick up my pace, and as I do, a hot gust of air and the smell of gas blow by with the passing of a big truck. This morning, when Paul said he needed the car all day, I decided to take it as a sign. I told him I'd get a ride home with Geraldine. She's a substance abuse counselor where I work. When I walked out the door, I knew everything I left in that house I'd be leaving for good. Most of it was easy to leave. But my medicine box, the one his dad had made for me, my fan, my gourd, my cedar bag, my shawl, these I'll have to learn to leave over time. I didn't see Geraldine all day, and not after work either. But I'd made my decision. I headed to the highway with nothing on me but my phone and a box cutter I took from the front desk before I left. The plan is to get to OKC, to the Greyhound station. The job doesn't start for a month. I just need to make it back to Oakland. A car slows, then stops ahead of me. I see red brake lights bleed through my vision of the night. I turn around in a panic, then hear Geraldine, so turn to see her old-ass beige Cadillac her grandma gave her for graduating from high school. When I get in the car, Geraldine gives me a look like, what the fuck? Her brother Hector is laid out in the back seat, passed out. "He okay?" I say. "Blue," she says, scolding me with my name. Geraldine's last name is Brown. Names that are colors is what we have in common. "What? Where are we going?" I say to her. "He drank too much," she says, "and he's on pain meds. I don't want him to throw up and die in his sleep on our living room floor, so he's riding with us." "Us? Why didn't you just ask me for a ride? You told Paul he called you?" I say. "Yeah. I was already home. I had to leave early for this fucker," Geraldine says, pointing with her thumb to the back seat. "I told Paul you had to stay late with a youth waiting for an auntie to show up, but that we were leaving soon." "Thank you," I say. "So you're going?" she says. "Yeah," I say. "Back to Oakland." "Yeah." "OKC Greyhound?" "Yeah." "Well, shit," Geraldine says. "I know," I say. And then our saying this makes a silence we drive in for a while. I see what I think is a human skeleton leaned against a barbed wire wood pole fence. "Did you see that?" I say. "What?" "I don't know. People think they see stuff out here all the time," Geraldine says. "You know that part of the highway you were walking? Up north a ways, just past Weatherford, there's a town there called Dead Women Crossing." "Why is it called that?" "Some crazy white lady killed and beheaded this other white lady, and sometimes teenagers go over to where it happened. The woman who got killed had her 14-month-old baby with her when she got killed. The baby made it out okay. They say you can hear that woman calling out for her baby at night." "Yeah, right," I say. "Ghosts aren't what you have to worry about out here," Geraldine says. "I brought a box cutter from work," I say to Geraldine, and pull it out of my jacket pocket and slide the plastic clip up to show her the blade, like she doesn't know what a box cutter is. "This is where they get us," Geraldine says. "Safer out here than at home," I say. "You could do worse than Paul." "I should go back then." "Do you know how many Indian women go missing every year?" Geraldine says. "Do you?" I say. "No, but I heard a high number once, and the real number's probably even higher." "I saw something too. Someone posted about women up in Canada." "It's not just Canada. It's all over. There's a secret war on women going on in the world. Secret even to us. Secret even though we know it," Geraldine says. She rolls down her window and lights a smoke. I light one too. "Every single place we get stuck out on the road," she says, "they take us, then leave us out here. Leave us to dim to bone, then get all the way forgotten." She flicks her cigarette out the window. She only likes a cigarette for the first few drags. I always think of the men who do that kind of thing, like, I know they're out there somewhere. "And Paul," she says. "You know what he's going through. He's not who we're talking about." "You're not wrong. But the difference between the men doing it and your average violent drunk is not as big as you think. Then you've got the sick pigs in high places who pay for our bodies on the black market with Bitcoin. Someone way up at the top who gets off on listening to the recorded screams of women like us being ripped apart, knocked against the cement floors and hidden rooms." "Jesus," I say. "What? You don't think it's real? The people who run this shit are real-life monsters. The people you never see. What they want is more and more, and when that isn't enough, they want what can't be gotten easily. The recorded screams of dying Indian women. Maybe even a taxidermied torso. A collection of Indian women's heads. There's probably some floating in tanks with blue lights behind them in a secret office on the top floor of an office building in Midtown Manhattan. You've given this some thought, I say. I meet with a lot of women, she says, trapped by violence. They have kids to think about. They can't just leave. With the kids, no money, no relatives. I have to talk to these women about options. I have to talk them into going to shelters. I have to hear about when the men accidentally go too far. So no, I'm not telling you that you should go back. I'm taking you to the bus station. But I'm saying you shouldn't be out here on the side of the highway at night. I'm saying you should have texted me. Asked me for a ride. I'm sorry, I say. I thought I'd see you after work. I feel tired and a little annoyed. I always get this way after a cigarette. I don't know why I smoke them. I yawn a big yawn, then lean my head against the window. I wake up to the blink blur of a struggle. Hector has his arms around Geraldine. He's reaching for the wheel. We're swerving, no longer on the highway. We're on Reno Avenue just across the bridge over the Oklahoma River, not far from the Greyhound station. Geraldine's trying to get Hector off of her. I slap Hector on his head over and over with both hands to try to stop him. He grunts like he doesn't know where he is or what he's doing. Or like he's woken up from a bad dream. Or like he's still having it. We swerve hard left, then harder right, and go over the curb, over some grass, and then into the Motel 6 parking lot, right into the front of a truck parked there. The glove compartment comes in and crushes my knees. My hands fly toward the windshield. The seatbelt pulls, then cuts into me. We stop and my vision blurs. The world spins a little. I look over and see that Geraldine's face is a bloody mess. Her airbag is out and it looks like it might have broken her nose. I hear the back door open and see Hector fall out of the car, then get up and stumble away. I turn my phone on to call an ambulance, and as soon as I do, I see that Paul's calling again. I see his name. His picture. He's in front of his computer at work wearing that I'm a hella hard Indian dude look, with his chin lifted. I pick up because I'm this close to the Greyhound. He can't do anything to me now. What? What the fuck do you want? We just got in a wreck, I say.
Where you at?
He says. I can't talk. I'm calling an ambulance. I say,
what are you doing in OKC?
He says, and my stomach drops. Geraldine looks at me and mouths, hang up. I don't know how you know that, but I'm hanging up now, I say.
I'm almost there,
Paul says. I hang up. Did you fucking tell him where we are? No, I did not fucking tell him where we are, Geraldine says, and wipes her nose with her shirt. Then how the fuck does he know we're here? I say, more to myself than to her. Shit. What? Hector must have texted him. Hector's all fucked up right now. I gotta go after him. What about your car? Are you okay? I'll be fine. Get to the bus station. Hide in the bathroom until the bus is ready to leave. What are you gonna do? Find my brother. Convince him to not keep doing whatever the fuck it is he thinks he's doing. How long has he been back? Only a month, she says. And he gets deployed again next month. I didn't even think we were still over there. I side-hug her. go, she says. I don't let go. Go, she says, and pushes me away. My knees are stiff and sore, but I run. The Greyhound sign stretches up like a beacon, but the lights are out. Is it too late? What time is it? I look at my phone. It's only 9. I'm okay. I look back and see Geraldine's car where we left it. No cops yet. I could call and wait for the police. Tell them what happened. Tell them about Paul. The station is empty. I go straight into the bathroom. On my feet, in a crouch, on top of the toilet in one of the stalls, I try to order my ticket on my phone. But he calls. I can't order because his calls keep interrupting me. I see a text at the top of my screen and try to ignore it but can't. You hear? The text says. I know he means the bus station. He must have seen Geraldine's car, seen how close the Greyhound station was. We're at a bar around the corner from where we crashed. I text. Bullshit, he texts back. Then he calls. I press the top button of my phone in. He's probably here, walking through the bus station. He's looking for the light of my phone, listening for its vibration. He won't come into the bathroom. I turn the vibrate on my phone off. I hear the door to the bathroom open. My heart is too big and fast to hold in my chest. I take a deep breath as quiet and slow as I can. Still standing on the toilet seat, I duck my head down to see who came in. I see women's shoes. It's an old woman. Big, beige, wide, velcroed shoes step into the stall next to mine. Paul calls again. I press the top button again. I see a text come in. Come on, baby. Come out. Where are you going? The text says. My legs are tired. My knees throb from the crash. I get down from the toilet. I pee and try to think of a text that might lead him away from here. I told you we're down the street. Come down. We'll have a drink. We'll talk through this, okay? I text him. The door to the bathroom opens again. I drop my head down again. Fuck. His shoes. I get back up on the toilet. Blue? His voice booms in the stall. This is the women's room, sir, the woman in the stall next to me says. There's no one in here but me. And I know she must have heard me in the next stall when I peed. Sorry, Paul says. There's still too much time before the bus gets here. He'll wait for the lady to leave and come back in. I hear the door open, then close again. Please, I whisper to the woman. He's after me. And I don't know what I'm asking her to do. What time's your bus leaving, darling? The woman says. 30 minutes, I say. Don't worry. When you get to my age, you can get away with that much time in here. I'll stay with you, she says. And I start to cry. Not loud, not a sob, but I know she can hear me. The snot comes, and I sniff in hard so it won't keep coming. Thank you, I say. This kind of man? They're getting worse. I'm gonna have to run out, I think. Run to the bus. I carry mace. I've been attacked, robbed, more than once. I'm going to Oakland, I say. And I realize just then that we're no longer whispering. I wonder if he's at the door. My phone isn't ringing anymore. I'll walk over with you, she says. I order the ticket on my phone. We walk out of the bathroom together. The station is empty. The woman is brown, ethnically ambiguous, and older than I thought even from the shoes. She has those deep wrinkles on her face that seem carved, wooden. She gestures for us to lock arms as we walk. I climb the steps into the bus, the old woman behind me. I show my ticket to the driver on my phone, then turn it off. I walk to the back and slink way down in my seat, take in a deep breath, then let it out, and wait for the bus to start moving.
Thomas Frank. Before you were born, you were a head and a tail in a milky pool, a swimmer. You were a race, a dying off, a breaking through, an arrival. Before you were born, you were an egg in your mom who was an egg in her mom. Before you were born, you were the nested Russian grandmother doll of possibility in your mom's ovaries. You were two halves of a thousand different kinds of possibilities. A million heads or tails, flip shine on a spun coin. Before you were born, you were the idea to make it to California for gold or bust. You were white, you were brown, you were red, you were dust. You were hiding, you were seeking. Before you were born, you were chased, beaten, broken, trapped on a reservation in Oklahoma. Before you were born, you were an idea your mom got into her head in the 70s, to hitchhike across the country and become a dancer in New York. You were on your way when she did not make it across the country, but sputtered and spiraled and wound up in Taos, New Mexico, at a peyote commune named Morningstar. Before you were born, you were your dad's decision to move away from the reservation, up to northern New Mexico to learn about a Pueblo guy's fireplace. You were the light in the wet of your parents' eyes as they met across that fireplace in ceremony. Before you were born, your halves inside them moved to Oakland. Before you were born, before your body was much more than heart, spine, bone, brain, skin, blood, and vein, when you just started to build muscle with movement, before you showed, bulged in her belly, as her belly, before your dad's pride could belly swell from the sight of you, your parents were in a room listening to the sound your heart made. You had an arrhythmic heartbeat. The doctor said it was normal. Your arrhythmic heart was not abnormal. Maybe he's a drummer, your dad said. He doesn't even know what a drum is, your mom said. Heart, your dad said. The man said arrhythmic. That means no rhythm. Maybe it just means he knows the rhythm so good he doesn't always hit it when you expect him to. Rhythm of what? She said. But once you got big enough to make your mom feel you, she couldn't deny it. You swam to the beat. When your dad brought out the kettle drum, you'd kick her in time with it. Or to her heartbeat. Or to one of the oldies mixtapes she had made from records she loved and played to no end in your Aerostar minivan. Once you were out in the world, running and jumping and climbing, you tapped your toes and fingers everywhere, all the time. On tabletops, desktops. You tapped every surface you found in front of you, listened for the sound things made back at you when you hit them. The timbre of taps, the din of dings, silverware clangs in the kitchens, door knocks, knuckle cracks, head scratches. You were finding out that everything makes a sound. Everything can be drumming whether rhythm is kept or strays. Even gunshots and backfire. The howl of trains at night. The wind against your windows. The world is made of sound. But inside every kind of sound lurked a sadness. In the quiet between your parents, after a fight they both managed to lose, you and your sisters listening through the walls for tones, listening for early signs of a fight. For late signs of a fight reignited. The sound of the worship service, that building drone and wail of evangelical Christian worship. Your mom speaking in tongues on the crest of that weekly Sunday wave. Sadness because you couldn't feel any of it in there and wanted to. Felt you needed it. That it could protect you from the dreams you had almost every night about the end of the world and the possibility of hell forever. You living there, still a boy, unable to die or leave or do anything but burn in a lake of fire. Sadness came when you had to wake up your snoring dad in church. Even as members of the congregation, members of your family, were being slain by the Holy Ghost in the aisles right next to him. Sadness came when the days got shorter at the end of summer, when the street got quiet without kids out anymore. In the color of that fleeting sky, sadness lurked. Sadness pounced, slid in between everything, anything it could find its way into, through sound, through you. You didn't think of any of the tapping or knocking as drumming until you actually started drumming many years later. It would have been good to know that you'd always done something naturally. But there was too much going on with everyone else in your family for anyone to notice you should probably have done something else with your fingers and toes than tap. With your mind and time, then knock at all the surfaces in your life like you were looking for a way in. You're headed to a powwow. You were invited to drum at the Big Oakland Powwow, even though you'd quit drum classes. You weren't going to go. You didn't want to see anyone from work since you got fired. Especially anyone from the powwow committee. But there's never been anything like it for you. The way that big drum fills your body to where there's only the drum, the sound, the song. The name of your drum group is Southern Moon. You joined a year after you first started working at the Indian Center as a janitor. You're supposed to say custodian now, or maintenance person, but you've always thought of yourself as a janitor. When you were 16, you went on a trip to Washington, D.C., to visit your uncle, your mom's brother. He took you to the American Art Museum, where you discovered James Hampton. He was an artist, a Christian, a mystic, a janitor. James Hampton would end up meaning everything to you. Anyway, being a janitor was just a job. It paid the rent, and you could have your earphones in all day. No one wants to talk to the guy cleaning up. The earphones are an additional service. People don't have to pretend to be interested in you because they feel bad that you're taking their trash out from under their desk and giving them a fresh bag. Drum group was Tuesday nights. All were welcome. Not women, though. They had their own drum group Thursday nights. They were Northern Moon. You first heard the big drum by accident one night after work. You'd come back because you'd forgotten your earphones. You were just about to get on the bus when you realized they weren't in your ears when you most wanted them, for that long ride home after work. The drum group played on the first floor, in the community center. You walked into the room and, just as you did, they started singing. High-voiced wailing and howled harmonies that screamed through the boom of that big drum. Old songs that sang to the old sadness you always kept as close as skin without meaning to. The word triumph blipped in your head then. What was it doing there? You never used that word. This was what it sounded like to make it through these hundreds of American years. To sing through them. This was the sound of pain forgetting itself in song. You went back every Tuesday for the next year. Keeping time wasn't hard for you. The hard part was singing. You'd never been a talker. You'd certainly never sung before. Not even alone. But Bobby made you do it. Bobby was big, maybe 6'4", 350. He said he was big because he came from 8 different tribes. He had to fit all of them in there, he said, pointing at his stomach. He had the best voice in the group, hands down. He could go high or low. And he was the one who first invited you in. If it was up to Bobby, the drum would be bigger, would include everyone. He'd have the whole world on a drum if he could. Bobby Big Medicine. Sometimes a name just fit right. Your voice is low like your dad's. You can't even hear it when I sing, he told Bobby after class one day. So what? Adds body. Bass harmony is underappreciated, Bobby told you, then handed you a cup of coffee. The big drum's all you need for bass, you said. Voice bass is different than drum bass, Bobby said. Drum bass is closed. Voice bass opens. I don't know, you said. Voice can take a long time to come all the way out, brother, Bobby said. Be patient. You walk outside your studio apartment to a hot Oakland summer day. And Oakland, you remember, is gray. Always gray. Oakland summer days from your childhood. Mornings so gray they filled the whole day with gloom and cool even when the blue broke through. This heat's too much. You sweat easy. Sweat from walking. Sweat at the thought of sweating. Sweat through clothes to where it shows. You take off your hat and squint up at the sun. At this point, you should probably accept the reality of global warming, of climate change. The ozone thinning again like they said in the 90s, when your sisters used to bomb their hair with Aquanet, and you'd gag and spit in the sink extra loud to let them know you hated it, and to remind them about the ozone. How hairspray was the reason the world might burn, like it said in Revelation. The next end. The second end after the flood. A flood of fire from the sky this time. Maybe from the lack of ozone protection. Maybe because of their abuse of Aquanet. And why did they need their hair 3 inches in the air, curled over like a breaking wave? Because what? You never knew. Except that all the other girls did it too. And hadn't you also heard or read that the world tilts on its axis ever so slightly every year, so that the angle made the earth like a piece of metal when the sun hits it just right, and it becomes just as bright as the sun itself? Hadn't you heard that it was getting hotter because of this tilt? This ever-increasing tilt of the earth? Which was inevitable and not humanity's fault. Not our cars, or emissions, or Aquanet, but plain and simple entropy? Or was it atrophy? Or was it apathy? You're near downtown, headed for the 19th Street BART station. You walk with a slightly dropped, sunken right shoulder, just like your dad's. The limp too, right side. You knew this limp could be mistaken for some kind of affect. Some lame attempt at gangsta lean. But on some level that you maybe didn't even acknowledge, you knew that walking the way you walk is a way of subverting the straight-postured, upright, citizenly way of moving one's arms and feet just so. To express obedience. To pledge allegiance to a way of life and to a nation and its laws. Left, right, left, and so on. But had you really cultivated this lean, this drop-shouldered walk, this way of swaying slightly to the right in opposition? Is it really some native-specific counter-cultural thing you're going for? Some vaguely anti-American movement? Or do you only walk the way your dad walked because genes and pain and styles of walking and talking get passed down without anyone even trying? The limp is something you've cultivated to look more like a statement of your individual style, and less like an old basketball injury. To get injured and not recover is a sign of weakness. Your limp is practiced, an articulate limp, which says something about the way you've learned to roll with the punches, all the ways you've been fucked over, knocked down, what you've recovered from or haven't, that you've walked or limped away from with or without style. That's on you. You pass a coffee shop you hate because it's always hot and flies constantly swarm the front of the shop, where a big patch of sun seethes with some invisible shit the flies love, and where there's always just that one seat left in the heat with the flies, which is why you hate it, on top of the fact that it doesn't open until 10 in the morning and closes at 6 in the evening to cater to all the hipsters and artists who hover and buzz around Oakland like flies. America's white suburban vanilla youth, searching for some invisible thing Oakland might give them, street cred or inner city inspiration. Before getting to the 19th Street station, you pass a group of white teenagers who size you up. You're almost afraid of them. Not because you think they'll do anything. It's how out of place they are, all the while looking like they own the place. You want to run them down, scream something at them, scare them back to wherever they came from, scare them out of Oakland, scare the Oakland they made their own out of them. You could do it, too. You're one of those big lumbering Indians. 6 feet, 230, chip on your shoulder so heavy it makes you lean. Makes everyone look at it. Your weight, what you carry. Your dad is 1,000% Indian. An overachiever. A recovering alcoholic medicine man from the res for whom English is a second language. He loves to gamble and smoke American Spirit cigarettes. Has false teeth. And prays for 20 minutes before every meal. Asks for help from the Creator for everyone. Beginning with the orphan children and ending with the servicemen and servicewomen out there. Your 1,000% Indian dad who only cries in ceremony and has bad knees that took a turn for the worse when he laid concrete in your backyard for a basketball court when you were 10. You know your dad could once play ball. Knew the rhythm of the bounce, the head fake and eye swivel. Pivot shit you learned how to do by putting in time. Sure, he leaned heavily on shots off the glass, but that was the way it used to be done. Your dad told you he hadn't been allowed to play ball in college because he was Indian in Oklahoma. Back in 1963, that was all it took. No Indians or dogs allowed on courts or in bars or off the reservation. Your dad hardly ever talked about any of it, being Indian or growing up on the res. Or even what he felt like now that he's a certifiable urban Indian. Except sometimes. When he felt like it. Out of nowhere. You'd be riding in his red Ford truck to Blockbuster to rent a movie. You'd be listening to your dad's peyote tapes. The tape staticky, gourd rattle and kettle drum boom. He liked to play it loud. You couldn't stand how noticeable the sound was. How noticeably Indian your dad was. You'd ask if you could turn it off. You'd make him turn off his tapes. You'd put on 106 KMEL, rap or R&B. But then he'd try to dance to that. He'd stick his big Indian lips out to embarrass you, stick one flat hand out and stab at the air in rhythm to the beat just to mess with you. That's when you'd turn the music off altogether. And that was when you might hear a story from your dad about his childhood. About how he used to pick cotton with his grandparents for a dime a day. Or the time an owl threw rocks at him and his friends from a tree. Or the time his great-grandma split a tornado in two with a prayer. The chip you carry has to do with being born and raised in Oakland. A concrete chip. A slab, really. Heavy on one side. The half side. The side not white. As for your mom's side, as for your whiteness, there's too much and not enough there to know what to do with. You're from a people who took and took and took and took. And from a people taken. You were both and neither. When you took baths, you'd stare at your brown arms against your white legs in the water and wonder what they were doing together on the same body, in the same bathtub.